Welcome to Mysterious Japan, created by Heath Havey and dedicated to the dark histories, ghost stories, and frightful folklore of Japan. These are the stories that give nightmares to the Japanese. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Episode 13, The Volcano Siren Call for Self-Immolation. Thanks to modern media and exploitative movies, many people today know about the so-called Suicide Forest, which we explored in Season 1. But most people have never heard of Mount Mihara, located on Izuoshima. From above, Mount Mihara dominates the southern half of the island. Its crater, slope, and caldera alone comprise almost half of the island. During the 1930s, thousands of people threw themselves into the lava-filled crater of this volcano. It all began in February 1933. Given its distance from the mainland, the island was only accessible by a ferry that took several hours to reach the island. From the docks, a 5-mile hike is required to reach the crater. The rash of suicides became known in Japan as the Mihara Curse, and Izuoshima became known as Suicide Island. In a time before satellites, iPhones, or televisions, the rash of suicides there attracted the attention of the global media. Part 1, A Forbidden Love. In February 1933, Kyoko Matsumoto is a 21-year-old student majoring in Japanese literature. She is desperately in love, but at the same time, she clings to a rage against society. Over the last few months, she has become infatuated with another student at the women's college she attends. She is coming in touch with her homosexuality, but in 1933 Japan, lesbian relationships are taboo. Lack of tolerance for sexual orientation minorities provides little option for people like Kyoko except to suffer in silence. Kyoko despises her own hopelessness and impotence to resolve the situation. The object of her yearning is fellow classmate Masako Tamita, who returns her love. Together, they feel the pressures to conform to a homogeneous and unforgiving society. They fall into despair. Although Masako resigns herself to this fate, Kyoko takes a much darker approach. She professes wanting to commit suicide via a lover's pact known as Shinju. She writes notes to Masako professing her love and asking her to join her in this suicide pact. Masako dismisses the requests as a passing fancy, but she becomes concerned when Kyoko persists in telling Masako about her suicidal ideations. In early February 1933, Kyoko sits down and pens a poignant and bewildering letter to Masako.
"Dearest Masako, it has come to this end. I am bewildered to distraction by the complexities of maturing womanhood. My anxieties have not abated since I last wrote. In fact, I have only become more resolute in my conviction to end the tragic deterioration of my physical and spiritual purity. Now I have only to determine the means. My father assures me that nobody ever survives a bonsai charge. Several times I have attempted this on my way home from school, hiding behind a hedge, and then leaping out at passers-by screaming bonsai, but have not yet met my goal of glorious annihilation. Father has forbidden me from ritual disembowelment in fear for the new carpet. I was at my wit's end when I had the most wonderful dream. I was standing at the edge of a volcano, gazing at the sky when I began to fall. It was the most thrilling feeling. I plunged headlong into the great bowl, and as my hair fluttered in the cleansing wind, I felt my soul burst from my body, screaming bonsai with great joy. Like the glorious phoenix, my soul flies with new life into the sun. Oh, Masako, it was so beautiful."
Masako stares at this bizarre letter, ready to flippantly tell Kyoko that it would be easier to just jump off the roof of a department store. But just a few months earlier, the department store's hired guards and fenced off cornices with barbed wire to prevent patrons from leaping to their deaths. After the letter, Kyoko persists in her ideation.
"I want to die in a way that will not leave an ugly corpse. I want to die a beautiful death."
Masako sits next to Kyoko in contemplation. Quoting from the letter, she says, half in jest,
"If you cannot bear the perplexities of maturing womanhood, I know just the volcano for you."
She reminds Kyoko of their school trip to Izuoshima the previous year. The volcano there is active, she reminds Kyoko, and Kyoko agrees it would be perfect. Though young Masako is filled with cunning and she has a plan, she knows Kyoko is serious, and the only way to talk her out of this is to take her there. No one will look into the volcano and follow through with jumping into the lava. She thinks this fascination will pass, and they can continue without the disturbing fantasy. Kyoko just needs to come to terms with reality. The two lovers spend the week spreading the news around campus that this lesbian lover's suicide will establish Mount Mahara as the place for lovers to commit Shinju. That Saturday, as Kyoko walks out the door, she tells her father,
"When I see the smoke of Mount Mahara, I think it's my mortuary tablet."
Her confused father does not understand what his daughter is saying, and he just watches her silently as she leaves for what he thinks is a day out on the town with her friend from school. After 4 hours on the ferry, they arrive at the northern side of the island. To the south, the volcano rises in stark contrast to the flat horizon. Having erupted countless times, Mount Mahara is revered by the Japanese as a sacred Gojinka, meaning fire of the gods. Despite major eruptions every 100 to 150 years, the small island is estimated to have been settled by the Japanese over 8,000 years ago. During its time as a penal colony, the volcano's venerated legacy is marred by what was termed a plague of suicides. Those exiled on the island, having lost hope, would fling themselves into the lava. Even in the 1930s, the volcano was known as a place of suicide. An average of 2 people each week threw themselves into the hot lava of the crater. This lava measures over 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. After spending the night at an inn, Kyoko and Masako begin the 5-mile hike to the top of the volcano on Sunday morning. Most of the path is a flat and narrow dirt trail leading south to the mountain crater. Deep trenches bank both sides of the path, making it a straight and narrow walk. Much of the trail is muddy and difficult to traverse, hindering progress. As they draw closer and past the trees, they see the plume rising from the volcano. The shifting haze of smoke has risen uninterrupted for hundreds of years. This plume is called to the hearts of maidens and lovers, the downtrodden and inconsolable since feudal time. Many souls, having lost all hope, have thrown themselves into this mountain. And now, it draws these two doomed lovers to its fiery core. Fumarole vents in the mountain leak sulfuric gases that float like never-ending wafts of smoke. They cover much of the area in a smoky, ethereal haze. At seeing the distant smoke rising, Masako tries to discourage Kyoko from her plans.
"This is not our future. It's not our future together. We have a life to live."
After Kyoko ignores her, Masako tries a different tactic. She draws Kyoko's attention to the camellia flowers in full bloom along the path.
"Remember that song about the color of a flower being mischief, and life is like that mischief. And we are like beggars who are envious, and the woman in the song lived to the age of 88. We have a life to live together."
"That song is like the height of ugliness as a woman, living to 88. That's a shameful song to recite to me."
Now Masako becomes worried that Kyoko will not be deterred. She engages a new tactic, pushing her feet deep into the muddy trail. She claims to be stuck in the mud and says they must turn back. But Kyoko continues forward, ignoring the ruse and leaving Masako to wallow in the mud. She points to the rising white smoke and tells Masako,
"The volcano will be my graveyard, and the white smoke will be the incense burning at my grave, just like my youth has been turned to smoke."
Masako frees her feet and catches up to Kyoko. They begin ascending the trail, winding counterclockwise about the volcano. Masako knows of a superstition claiming that if someone walks counterclockwise around a volcano or island, death will result. Her heart flutters as she struggles to keep up with Kyoko. It is a 2,500-foot climb to the summit of the crater. Kyoko never pauses along the way. At the top, they see the crater spewing white smoke with a roaring noise. Masako notices that Kyoko's expression has turned from a smile to a pale, emotionless mask. From the summit at this time of day, the sun shines brightly down and they can clearly see the lava about 90 feet below. To Masako, the lava resembles a red, doughy hell, The heat is palpable at the top, even in the cool February air. She feels that she is standing in front of a campfire. A sulfurous updraft hits Masako, pushing her back. She takes one step at a time away from the edge, but Kyoko stands there looking down. She steps up to the observation point and stares down transfixed, taking off her red sash sandals. Kyoko goes right to the edge. After a moment, she turns around, her back to the crater. A relieved Masako thinks Kyoko has reconsidered. Kyoko walks to Masako and hands her two envelopes. In confusion, Masako looks down at the two envelopes placed into her hands. When she looks up again, she sees Kyoko walking to the edge once more. It is at that moment that Masako realizes what she holds in her hands. It is customary to provide suicide notes. Kyoko turns her back to the crater and stretches her hands to the side.
Give my regards to everyone in class. Goodbye.
Oh, no, Kyoko-san, don't.
Masako runs forward and grabs Kyoko by the sleeve of her kimono, trying to grapple her friend. She grabs the purple obi sash around Kyoko's waist to pull Kyoko back from the edge. Across the crater, a 24-year-old man watches the struggle as he is running around to help. The island has appointed him as the crater watchman for this day. His job is to circle the crater and prevent suicide attempts, but the girls reach the caldera when he is on the far side of the crater and he cannot get to them in time. He describes the incident as seeing the two become entangled. Then one of them flies backward into the crater with the purple obi from her kimono flapping in the wind. His report describes it as though seeing a purple cicada jumping 30 meters down into the lava. In horror, Masako watches Kyoko fall backward into the smoke and land in the lava below. For a moment, it seems like Kyoko is taking a swim, but a body falling into lava does not sink like it would in liquid. Instead, it floats atop the molten rock as the individual is cooked to death in their own steam. This steam is created from the water in the body vaporizing as it comes into contact with the lava. One moment, Kyoko struggles on top of the lava, but a moment later, the lava swallows her whole. Masako stands looking over the edge, clutching the two envelopes. By the time the watchman reaches her, he finds her crying openly in a stupor. She pushes him away and staggers down the mountain path alone. At the bottom of the mountain, another watchman sees Masako descend and becomes suspicious. He remembers seeing her go up with a companion, and now she descends alone. He also notices that Masako wears the red sash sandals previously worn by Kyoko. When confronted by him, she admits that her friend jumped into the crater, but she then walks past him in a daze. When questioned during an investigation later, the ferry boatman recalls that he had taken two young women in the boat together to the island, but that only one returned. As the ferry heads back to Tokyo, he asks Masako about her friend. Masako stands silent for a moment, mouth agape, before replying without emotion that Kyoko committed suicide. The two suicide notes are addressed to a friend and to Kyoko's mother. The letter to her mother reads, "I'm killing the person I hate the most. It's not the best part of me." Masako delivers the notes and tells everyone at school that Kyoko committed suicide by jumping into the volcano. Her demeanor has changed now. To them, she seems to gush about Kyoko's glorious leap into the volcano, a far cry from the despondent and stupefied state immediately after Kyoko's death. It will soon come to light that Masako has a terrible secret. Part 2. Masako's Scandal. The press soon picks up on the story of Masako and Kyoko. They label it, quote, a bizarre suicide. As the media swarms and the story makes national headlines, Masako finds herself the center of criticism for taking Kyoko to the island, failing to report the intended suicide, and sensationalizing it at school. They blame her for Kyoko's death. To the newspapers, she is a conspirator and maybe even a cold-blooded killer. The media brands her the witness of death. As a preventative measure, the principal of Jisen Girls College sends Masako to her home in Saitama Prefecture to wait out the media storm. The day after her arrival, the next shock hits the news cycle. They have discovered her secret. In its February 15, 1933 edition, the Yomiuri Shimbun, it calls Masako a, quote, death guide who has now twice led schoolgirls to their death. It reports Masako's bizarre behavior as a woman who invites death to Mount Mihara by twice guiding her schoolmates to the crater. Just a month before Kyoko's death, the newspaper noted Masako witnessed another friend's suicide at Mount Mihara. Another major newspaper, the Asahi Shimbun, highlights her strange behavior with one article called "A Schoolgirl's Bizarre Suicide" and another called "Creepy Summit Confession." But the media is just getting started. On February 16, 1933, the Yomiuri Shimbun reveals Kyoko's secret. At the end of 1932, just 1 month prior to her relationship with Kyoko, Masako engaged in a lesbian relationship with a 24-year-old senior named Saiko. Seiko suffers from mental illness and depression. The school grants her an extended absence. Like Kyoko, Seiko feels the oppression of a society that does not tolerate sexual minorities. In December 1932, she speaks to Masako extensively about her intent to commit suicide and put an end to her suffering. Masako pleads with Seiko to change her mind, but on January 7, 1933, Seiko approaches Masako about her plans. Ever since the class trip to Mount Mihara, she feels a need to end her life in the volcano. She already left a note in her room for the housekeeper to find that reads, "I'm leaving home so I can rely on myself for a while, so please don't worry." She wants her family to believe she will return, even though she has no intention of doing so. "I need you to go with me," she tells a distraught Masako. "I don't trust myself to follow through with it alone." Masako feels great sympathy for Seiko, but hesitates. "Please," Seiko asks again, "I can't do this if you're not with me." Masako relents. Seiko makes her promise a solemn vow not to tell anyone about her death for 5 years. They have to believe she is alive so that their grief will be less when they finally learn the truth. On January 7, 1933, they head out on the ferry. It is just 5 weeks before she will take the same ferry with Kyoko. Masako follows Seiko to the mouth of the volcano the next morning. Masako later describes herself as full of anxiety, but Seiko makes her renew her promise. And Masako says, "I won't tell anyone about this for 5 years." At the lip of the crater, Seiko tells Masako, "I can't die with you here watching. Please go down and let me do this myself." So Masako descends the mountain. She never sees Seiko throw herself into the sulfur-belching maw of the crater. Fear fills her heart as she walks down the trail, but she intends to honor the vow of secrecy. Seiko had given Masako another letter to leave at her house, and Masako obediently leaves it there. It tells them that she is going out on her own and asks them not to go looking for her. Her family believes the letter and thinks Seiko will return someday. After Kyoko's death, Masako breaks her vow. She tells some of her friends at school that she shares a secret promise with Seiko and that her day to go to heaven already approached. "We climbed Mount Mihara on January 8th, she says, "and we shared a secret there." The investigations by the media and the police after Kyoko's death uncover the details of Seiko's suicide. They confirm that she went to Izu Oshima with a friend but never returned. Upon interrogation, Masako confesses everything. She is still at home on leave from the school, and she falls into a deep depression. The names they call her weigh upon her mind each day. And the newspapers are relentless. The Asahi Shimbun reports,
"Fire-breathing, Mount Mihara's best friend is Masako, the guide of death."
Others call her the Reaper and the indirect murderer who will not stop. The police clear Masako and do not charge her with any crimes. The media pays this no attention. Instead, their investigations uncover that Masako provided Sayako's mother with a note the night before she departed to Mihara. The note tells her mother that she does not know Sayako's new address and cannot find out, even if she asks the girls at school. It says she was sorry, but please don't bother asking where she went. All focus on the tragedy of these two young girls as suicide victims, and the inequalities of society takes a backseat to bringing judgment down on Masako. The media writes that these deaths were brought about by her evil hand, and that she was a perverted and cold-blooded lesbian. as the story gains traction and spreads to newspapers across the country. Their sexual orientation becomes the primary focus, creating a new cultural meme in Japan of lesbian suicides. Being the center of the nation's intense hatred and the media's constant bombardment sends Masako into a spiral of self-hate. Her family says she has become sick with a cold. Later, they report that she suffers from mental illness, which they claim is emotional distress caused by her public treatment. In the midst of the continuing firestorm of media coverage, on May 1, 1933, less than 3 months after Kiyoko's death, Masako's family reports to the town hall that Masako passed away on April 29 from a form of meningitis. On her pillow, she had reverently placed pictures of Kiyoko and Seiko. Her family provide no further details about her death at the time. The tabloids claim that Masako is cursed and that the two souls she sent to the underworld have come back to claim revenge. But the truth was that Masako had succumbed to the media firestorm and had taken her own life. Her parents try to preserve her dignity, but the media firestorm breaks through their veil of privacy. The following month, Masako's brother Hiro vehemently blames the media. In an interview in June 1933, he says,
"Please remember my sister Masako, who was oppressed by the world. Journalism killed my flesh and bone sister. They exhausted her with their inhumane articles. She had two unhappy friends who could not find the love of others in our society. They were her best friends. The media sensationalism has focused too much on these Mihara incidents and will bring about the dawn of a Shinju boom."
He does not realize how prophetic his statements are. Part 3. The Plague of Suicides. Thanks to media exploitation, copycat suicides begin in February, just a few days after Kiyoko's death. The nation divided into one group that romanticized the lover suicides and the other side, including the media, viciously attacked Masako to find blame and to sell papers. As copycat suicides increase, the phenomenon is dubbed the lover's suicide rage. People begin calling the observation point of the volcano suicide point. Between February and March 1933, Izu Oshima authorities report 67 people attempting suicide at the volcano. Of these, 32 are successful. This is about one suicide attempt per day and one successful attempt every 2 days. The half that do not commit suicide are either stopped by patrols or spectators, or in some cases, their jump does not result in death. In March 1933, a young man complains that he is tired of being short and treated like a little boy by his peers. He walks up to the edge of the crater on the verge of jumping, but spectators grab him and hold him back. They talk to him and manage to convince him to change his mind. Others are not so lucky. The lip to the crater is rimmed by a complex caldera with ledges. Sulfuric smoke obscures vision in many places. The straight drop from suicide point becomes inaccessible by the suicide patrol and fences that authorities build around that area, and it becomes crowded with spectators. Many deaths are not caused by the lava, but instead by people misjudging distances and landing on one of the ledges toward the bottom of the caldera. Others fall near the lava but end up dying slowly in agony from contact burns or radiant heat. Others die by asphyxiation from volcanic gases. Those who survive the drop sometimes are lucky enough to land on one of the ledges, where they usually rethink their decision, and then climb back to the top with assistance from spectators or the patrol. Rescue crews struggle to save those who survive the jump, but often without success. Over the year, at least 1,200 reported attempts are unsuccessful. Most of these are thwarted by police and rescuers before any jump takes place. But some who jump survive the plunge, change their minds, and cannot climb to the top due to injury or the steep wall. In those cases, rescue crews lower themselves with ropes, often with a crane assistance. Some survive. Far too many do not. The Asahi Shimbun reports the grisly news on a daily basis from February through April. One report indicates the two ferries setting sail on April 29th carry over 750 people, far more than usual, but reports that 4 additional ferries are chartered to bring in an additional 850 visitors in the evening. The article admits that visitors do not come in just to see the charm of Izu-Ōshima, but to climb the volcano and possibly witness a suicide attempt. Before long, advertisements inviting tourists warn them that the ferries are overcrowded. By May, an average day includes a crowd of 1,500 people surrounding the crater. Over 150,000 people visit the crater in 1933 alone. The crowds surge to the point that newspapers separate them into 2 groups called the suicide class and the mob. On the afternoon of May 7th alone, in front of 1,500 onlookers, the crater guards stop 10 men and 15 women from jumping into the lava. This seems like a success, but they fail to stop 6 men from jumping. Another man poisons himself in front of horrified tourists. After this, the Asahi newspaper revisits the data and reports that the average number of suicide attempts has reached 6 per day. On May 9th, a man from Kyoto spreads his arms in front of the crowd and jumps in like a bird. The May 10th edition of the Asahi Shinbun calls him the man who flies to death. Some of the onlookers assist in prevention. They talk several young people out of jumping. A young woman and 2 young men from Matsuba discuss their plans, and the tourists nearby, hearing this, talk them out of the idea. Another trend also starts. Young people wanting to run away from home state to their parents, "I'm going to Mihara," then they leave home and are never seen again. In many cases, they disappear without going to Mihara. But the identity of many flinging themselves into the lava are never known. Their bodies are completely immolated and remains are not recoverable. Following this macabre trend, one man working at a supermarket tells his co-workers, "Look at me now and say goodbye, because I'm going to Mihara to jump in." And no one knows what happened to him. Journalists also hover near the crater. They begin developing some theories. Some say the crater has a personality like a living thing, and that it creates a foamy morphology of the times fashionable but outdated and addictive. 2 new phrases coined by the newspapers enter the Japanese lexicon: Mihara disease and Mihara patients. In July, the crowd witnesses 4 men throwing themselves into the crater one after another like dominoes, but one catches himself at the last moment, teetering on the edge before being pulled back into the crowd. As it turns out, none of them are trying to commit suicide. Instead, the crowd is so thick that the 4 men collided into each other and 3 fell accidentally into the crater. The 4th can only watch in horror and gratefulness as his life is spared. In an effort to squeeze more coverage from the tragedy, newspapers fund expeditions to go down into the crater itself. On May 1st, 1933, the Jiji Shinpo newspaper flashes the front page headline: "Headquarters reporters going down Mihara crater." They brag about descending 90 to 120 feet down into the center amongst a crowd of onlookers. The self-aggrandizing article states that it will set the record of the century. Not to be outdone, Yomiuri Shimbun conducts its own expedition to descend to the bottom of the Mihara crater. They begin working on this project. Then, on May 30th, the Yomiuri newspaper issues the article entitled "Successful Global Expedition, Searching for the Bottom of Mihara Crater." Yomiuri brags about sending probes 1,250 feet down, more than 10 times as far as Jiji Shinpo. Yomiuri considers it a bonus when it finds a body at the bottom of the crater near the lava. Its reporter is exploring the inside edge of the crater when he comes upon the skeleton lying on a rock, twisted with broken bones and decaying rapidly in the intense heat. On May 31st, the body is identified as a 17-year-old boy. After leaving home on the morning of May 16th, his parents discover a letter left by him claiming, "I am too short to be born." The boy's family and the store owner where he worked never knew he was despondent over being short. His death both baffles and aggrieves them. As for government response to the expeditions, Prime Minister Saito issues a congratulatory discourse, calling the expeditions a victory of science and human power. Saito himself does not take the opportunity to attempt suicide prevention. Rather, he seems intent on turning a social disaster into a political and media opportunity. Saito will be assassinated 3 years later in the infamous coup called the February 26th incident. And thus the terrible cycle of the volcano swallowing the troubled, lovelorn and despairing souls continues day after day and month after month. On August 21st, a young man stands at the crater silently clasping his hands together. He is a college student, and he brings incense to memorialize the spirits of the suicide victims. The tourists watch with respect as he lights an incense stick and throws it into the crater in memory of the dead. Then he takes a few steps back, head bowed. Before anyone can say or do anything, he suddenly takes a running leap into the volcano. An investigation reveals that he had problems with his adoptive parents. He believes they lost all love for him with the birth of their biological child. After leaving home, he struggles to keep up with his studies, and his relationship with his family worsens, leading to his decision to jump. He leaves behind a suicide note at the tea house on Oshima where he spent the night. It reads, "The ephemeral spring morning licks leaves in a line. Indulge the night, open the window, there's a star up there for me to be my lover." On September 8th, a 20-year-old young man in a school uniform steps up to the edge and calmly removes his school hat and coat. He bows to the crater and jumps. The horrified spectators find his identification card in the pocket of his jacket, along with a notebook containing a suicide note, which states that he is in calm despair, like being pulled on the current of a wind, and he does not want to be a part of the rhythm of destruction anymore. "Because every cynical thing inside me is cut off by death." Public discourse begins comparing the path to the crater to a pilgrimage leading to a shrine. Locals carefully bank, drain, and level the path for expansion. Schoolgirls make class holidays out of visiting the island. Newspapers report that the path to the crater is lined with people from 4 a.m. to dusk. The Mahara crater has become a mecca of despondent lovers seeking to carry out suicide pacts, just as Masako's brother predicted. But it also becomes something even more sinister. Part 4. Exploitation of the suicide tragedies at Mihara. Jinojo Hayashi sees an opportunity in this rash of suicides on the island, a business opportunity. As president of the Tokyo Bay Steamship Company, he leaps at the opportunity to profit from this so-called plague of suicides. The media mocks him as the go-getting suicide tycoon after he increases the number of ferries to the island from 3 trips per week to 2 luxurious and large ships, each making 2 trips per day. But that is not all. He begins tours to take visitors directly from the docks to the suicide point at the crater. From 1933 to 1937, Izu Oshima sees an economic boom. Hotel revenues triple. Restaurants overflow with customers. Business owners don't seem to mind why visitors are coming, as long as they keep coming. One of them owns a stable with 12 horses for hire. He reports expanding his stock to 40 horses to take people to the top of the crater. He previously had no competition, but now he reports having 3 competitors on the island. Another businessman imports 6 donkeys from China. He expands this to 35 donkeys and then complains to reporters that he cannot keep up with demand. Meanwhile, Hayashi, that go-getting suicide tycoon, keeps up with competition and then some. To outdo these horse and donkey businessmen, he imports 4 Mongolian camels to the island. A line of tourists, 3 deep wait to ride camels to the crater. And since he owns the ferry company, he can lead the tourists straight from the ferries to the camels and then to Suicide Point without the competition having any opportunity to compete. Within the first year, this previously poor fishing and farming island has transformed into a prosperous community, taking the money of tourists coming to see people throw themselves into a volcano. By the end of 1933, 3 per day jump into the crater. But many speculate that if the undiscovered bodies are included in the count, that number would swell and possibly double. Between 1934 and 1935, Izu Oshima becomes known worldwide as the Suicide Island. Although about 4 suicide attempts are thwarted each day, too many are not stopped in time. The phenomenon draws the attention of the United States and Time magazine. In its January 28, 1935 edition, Time magazine highlights this unsettling trend at Izu Oshima. "Suicide has gone cheap," the article reads. And just how has it gone cheap? The article focuses in on Hayashi and his exploitation of the suicides there. During the week of the article, a triple plunge of suicides into that sulfur-stinking maw of death drew the attention of sensation-hungry tourists. These types of events, according to the article, score another coup for Hayashi. Time magazine calls out Hayashi further for providing, quote, "all sorts of conveniences to get passengers from the landing dock up sulfur-belching Mihara to popular suicide point on the crater's brim." It mentions Hayashi importing the first camels ever into Japan, just to take people to the crater's edge, hoping to see a suicidal plunge into the lava below. After the second set of triple suicides, Hayashi's PR machine conjectures.
"The god of death must now have taken up his abode in Mihara and is calling men in trees to their doom."
Time magazine notes that Hayashi provides tour guides for the thrill-seeking tourists, and then these tour guides regale them with stories of gruesome suicides. It discusses the tour guide session, where the tourists see a suicide play out before their eyes. The following quotes from the Time magazine article.
"First, a Japanese youth in neat store clothes suddenly broke from the tourist ranks just as a sulfur cloud belched up and leaped into the crater. Next, with a wild yell, a second youth in store clothes followed the first. After that, for minutes nothing happened. The tourists, their nerves tingling with thrills, turned gradually away and began to leave the crater. Just then, a mild-mannered young man in a Japanese kimono inched imperceptibly toward the edge. Several Japanese ladies screamed as he stripped off his kimono, revealing a handsome torso stark naked. Police cried the ladies, 'Stop him!' But clean as an arrow, the young man's body sped, disappearing into the curling yellow fumes and then spattering on the so-called death ledge about 600 feet below."
But unfortunately, Time magazine and the eye of the world could do nothing to stop these tragic incidents of self-immolation in the molten center of Mount Mihara. Many believe that these tragedies and the exploitation of these tragedies cemented a Tatari curse on this island. As we discussed in season 1, a Tatari curse is a place so fraught with evil, emotion, and tragedy that even the gods have abandoned it and have left it to be overrun by evil and curses. Over the centuries, this tiny island was subject to exiles and criminals stuck on its shores, many left so desperate that they jumped into the volcano. It was the place of exile for the powerful wizard feared by the emperor. It was the subject of a Killing Kappa legend and an evil dictator who subjugated, tortured, and killed his subjects on the island. And this became the legend of the 25 forsaken young men who tried to save the village but were betrayed by their own kinsfolk. And on top of this, the legend of that evil dictator's spirit drowning those in the sea. Revenge, tragedy, evil, desperation, and exploitation abound on this tiny island. Added to these centuries of terror and legend, the thousands throwing themselves into the crater in the 1930s, and the island residents exploiting those tragedies, certainly seemed to add to the curse on the island. But there is more. On one hand, a hero rose up to quell the suicides and stop the madness. But on the other hand, a series of events over the last 9 decades seem to justify its reputation as a cursed island. All this and more, explored in the next episode of The Mysterious Japan.
This has been Mysterious Japan, created, written, and translated by Heath Havey. Thank you for listening and making this podcast possible. Please visit our website at www.themysteriousjapan.com for more information. Please join us next time as we continue to explore the dark histories and strange mysteries of Japan.